The Asian Classics Institute presents A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, Part 3, with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in New York City in October of 1997. This is the beginning of Class 4.
I thought it would clear out a little bit, but pretty good. Any few questions about that anymore? No? My Lama would say, oh, you all understood it perfectly. Yeah. Yeah, right. That's a pretty good point. Leon said, Leon said, if you assume that the object helps cause the awareness of it, it's called a mikyan in Buddhist philosophy. It means a perceptual condition, meaning that, when you hold a pen up and the awareness of the pen happens a minute later, a millisecond later. The pen has to precede the perception of it. And that, I was talking about that because it was one of the reasons why there's no subject without a corresponding object. That's a tenet of Buddhism, that if there's no object to be seen, then you can't have a subject, okay, subject state of mind. So it does sound like if the pen existed the millisecond before you saw it, that it's not true that it's a projection, because the projection should come later, right? The projection is a creation of the mind. So it seems to be contradictory. You could say that the data, the colors and shapes, are projected a millisecond before the projection of the pen, okay? Something like that, all right? So you're projecting, there's a dakshi, which means the data, the raw data. And then there's a dokche, which means the mind that organizes the data into an object. And then a second later, there's a dakche, which means an organized object such as the pen. So the dakshi is the colors and shapes. The dokche is the state of mind which projects onto it, or which, I thought of a good word the other day. What's it? Imputes or lays onto it. But there's another word. Can't remember. Anyway, it imputes or lays onto it the idea of pen. And then a millisecond. You can say a scribe. I Ascribed to me means this text is ascribed to a Sangha, but we really know it's by Nagarjuna, you know? So ascribed means, you know, falsely imputed. This is tsema. Tsema means it's a reasonable ascription, you see? It's tsema. Tsema means reasonable if not accurate, okay? I used to try to convince my boss of the difference between a reasonable decision and a correct decision. You know what I mean? Like, based on what I knew, I made a correct decision. Now, it happened to be work out wrong later on, but based on what I knew, that's all I could come up with. I made the best decision possible, even though later it turned out to lose the company a lot of money. You know, because according to all I knew at that time, that was reasonable. So that's a tsema is reasonable. So to me, ascribe means, you know, that there's no reason to ascribe it to a Sangha. It was really by Nagarjuna. But anyway, it's dok. Dok means to label. To put something, impose. I like the word impose. You're imposing pen upon those that data. Okay, all you really see is colors and shapes. So colors and shapes precede the perception of the colors and shapes. And they help create the perception of the colors and shapes. And then they're interpreted by the mind as a pen. And then a moment later, a thing called a pen exists. And then a moment later, the perception of the pen exists. How's that? Okay, so you get data. Perception of data, organization of data, you know, imposed object, and then awareness of the imposed object. How's that? Yeah. Oh, by the way, so Leon said, well, you know, on a one-by-one basis, all the stuff you talk about sounds reasonable. But why is it that suddenly 85 people in this room would all collectively perceive this thing as a pen? That's just the result of common karma, what we call common karma, you know. And it's true that, generally speaking, the big division is by the five rik, drawa rik duk, or five or six classes of beings. The big divisions are between them. Like bugs, the animal realm doesn't perceive things at all like the human realm does. And that's all, only two realms we accept in America. But hell realm people and pretas, hungry ghosts, would perceive the same objects in a much, much different way. But you can accept at least that an animal and a human perceive the same object in a much different way. If we all happen to see a pen, all the people in this room, it's because we all had a similar karmic cause to see the pen. And that's, in fact, if you think about it carefully, that's why there's six kinds of beings. It's not the other way around. The fact that there's six kinds of beings is not self-existent. The reason we're all called humans is that we're all having similar karmic ripenings in our minds, and that puts us all in the same boat. It's very interesting. It's not that there's a class of things called humans independent of that fact. It's the fact that we all see things in a similar way because we all collected similar karma is why we're called humans. You see, it's very delicate. Think about it like that. But Master Shantideva would say, look, that's similar to the argument that, oh, this has been going on so long, then shouldn't it be self-existent, you know? I've been perceiving this so long that it must have some reality. And then he says, look, you know, it's all a dream. It doesn't matter whether the dream, in a dream, you can dream something you can remember a day's passing in a dream, and you can remember hundreds of years passing in a dream, or a whole lifetime passing in a dream. But when you wake up, the argument that one is more true because it's been going on longer in your dream is not valid. And the fact that more people are seeing something as something doesn't make it more self-existently that way. I think he would argue the same way. He does that about time, you know, so I think he'd say it about the number of people seeing things. We know that it's possible for large masses of people to misperceive something like Hitler. You know, we know that it's possible for millions of people to follow this crazy guy because they're all having the same karma at the same time to think he's a great guy or something like that. It doesn't make it right that, or the abortion, you know, it doesn't make it right that many people think that way. You see what I mean? It doesn't make it more right. In fact, you know, Buddhists are such a tiny minority and happen to be completely right, and yeah, there are. I mean, yeah. Assuming no two people are the emanation of one being. Seriously, okay? Which is possible. Yeah. It's possible there's 84 emanations in here of being projected by one Buddha, and I'm the only non-Buddha here. You know, seriously. You know, yeah. But if they're not, then there's 85 mind streams going on here, and they will never mix together because. Oh. Yeah. Generally perceiving the same thing. You know, generally you can all say you're seeing me. You're seeing my shapes and colors. You know, and apparently you all have the karma to see me as Michael Roach or something. Excuse me. Because of the ripening of karma is an individual thing. It's very interesting. You know. Yeah, you are the sum total of the ripening of your karmic seeds. You see, even David Sykes, for David Sykes, is the sum total of the ripening of David Sykes' karmic seeds, and it will always be that way. It's funny. You think you're a person, and you're right. Just because so many seeds are going off at the same time, they make you think it like that. And it'll always be like that. Yeah. You're talking about the pieces of the parts of the parts, and we're going to get to that later on. I've been carefully avoiding it because Master Shantideva gets into it later. We will talk. I promise we'll talk about it. This, if I keep promising you some tidbits, you might come back, you know. Yeah. We are saying, the Madhyamika says, the stuff is not there in the way you thought it was, but it is there. How is it there? It's there because you're projecting onto it what you see. Okay? It's not coming from its side the way it looks like it is. That's all. But it still functions. You can still get run over by a car, even though it's your projection. Okay? One more question, then we got to start, because you guys will be here all night. Yeah. Who? No, they would say the same thing. They would say the same thing. Every school, even down to the lowest school, the Vaibhashika, second chapter, Abhidharma Kosha, sets forth five conditions, and that's one of them. Every Buddhist school accepts that the mind is a one of the conditions for the arisal of a state of mind is the presence of its object. So, you know. They say it comes from the same karmic seed, but I think they would say that one maybe comes a moment before or something like that. How's that? You know, the same karmic seed makes that pew occur a millisecond before my awareness of it. Okay? Like, it's not outside of the laws of karma that the same karmic seed causes that a millisecond before it causes my perception of it. Like that. Okay. How's that? All right. We better get... in the debate ground, they teach us when to change the subject. Okay. We're through with the mind-only school. Now they're going on to different proofs for the existence of emptiness and for the importance of emptiness. But now we start out with an argument, mostly by two groups called the listeners and the self-made Buddhas. These are two Hinayana groups. These are two lower, I call them lower way. Hina means, Mamba in Tibetan means lower. Yana means way. Does it mean that they're stupid? No, they are brilliant, okay? Does it mean that we should reject them? No, we're not allowed to reject them. That's a bodhisattva vow. Does it mean that some of their explanations are wrong? Yes. Okay. Are all the people who are called Theravadins or Hinayana in the world not concerned about saving all sentient beings? I doubt it. Okay. Of course they're concerned about saving all sentient beings. So Hinayana is a theoretical group of people. Okay. Who theoretically aren't interested in saving all sentient beings. They would like to reach happiness themselves. and they're not so concerned about spreading it to other people. So this is a theoretical group of people that Master Shantideva is attacking. Probably there were people in his time who has said that it was important to reach your individual nirvana, but not to help all other living beings. Okay, if you read the Abhidharma Kosha, which is supposed to be one of their books, it's full of helping all sentient beings. So, okay, so we're talking about a theoretical thing, and I'm not putting down all the Theravada or Hinayana schools in the world. Yeah. No, the mind-only school is a Mahayana school, and the other two schools, the Vaibhashika and the South Trantika, are Hinayana schools. Okay. So anyway, there are some Hinayanists, okay, theoretical Hinayanists, who come to the Shantideva, Master Shantideva, and they say, look, you can start trying to prove emptiness to us, but why? What's the use of it? You don't need to see emptiness to get to Nirvana and Buddhahood, okay? They say that. Not necessary. So then Master Shantideva says, well, what do you have to see to get to Nirvana and Buddhahood? And they say, yeah, it's one of my case. It's not self-existent, because I see it as a cave, but you don't. Okay? Say, mitak, so, chudu. Mitak, so, chudu. Mitak means impermanent or changing. Okay? Changing. Sok means etc. Chuduk means 16. Chuduk means 16. The number 16. Okay. These are known as the 16 aspects of the four so-called noble truths. Okay, the four noble truths. The way it really happens is like this. I've mentioned it before, but I'll go through it again. I'll start with staring at the pot on the stove, which we've been talking about, right? So you're standing there staring at the pot on the stove, and suddenly you get it that you're not watching a pot, you're watching a bunch of colors and shapes, and that there never was any pot out there, and that what's making it a pot is your own mind. And your own mind, forced by your past karma, is organizing those colors and shapes into a perfect little picture of a pot, which is only about that big and is somewhere back here. Okay, it's not out on the stove. All these years you've only been watching pictures of pots in your mind. Your eye never saw a pot. Your eye can only see colors and shapes. We got that out already. You go in the temple an hour later, you go into a deep state of meditation, and you see emptiness directly for like 20 minutes. You come down out of that meditation, and it's like a physical sensation of coming down from another realm, because that state of meditation is related to the form realm. Okay, and there's a physical sensation of coming down out of the meditation. Then you're back to seeing normal things again, and you begin to have a series of extraordinary experiences for the rest of the day, like even up to the evening. And you realize, you have deep spiritual realizations, which are not the perception of emptiness, okay? Throughout the whole day. The moment you see emptiness, the first instant of the 20 minutes, you are already an Arya, okay? Pakpa in Tibetan. Meaning, you are a person who has seen emptiness directly. So from the very first instant, from the first millisecond of seeing emptiness directly, you have changed status. You are now a different kind of being. You're what we call a realized being. Okay. The word Arya can be translated as noble. Okay, noble one. Or it literally means higher one. Okay, not noble. Noble to me means virtuous or self-sacrificing or like that. It has nothing to do with that in the direct perception of emptiness. You are a higher being now. Okay, you are a different kind of being. You are one in a billion. You know, you are one in maybe a billion or more. Okay, you are one of those people who has seen emptiness directly. After living countless lifetimes, within typically seven lifetimes, you will now be enlightened. So you are a totally different kind of being. That's what Arya means. It doesn't mean noble. Okay, all those ideas that you get, those great spiritual perceptions that you get, after that, after you come down out of emptiness, for the rest of the day, okay? Some of them sitting still on your meditation seat, and other ones happening while you're walking around afterwards. All of those things are called the four Arya truths. The four truths that are seen by a person who has just seen emptiness directly. Okay? So I don't think they should be called noble. That's a mistranslation that came from some early Western translations, and hopefully we can stamp it out, but looks like we might get stuck with it. They are the four Arya truths. Okay? Typically they can be grouped into like 16 different great ideas that you get. And these are the 16 aspects of impermanence, etc. Okay? You can divide all of those experiences into four big groups. Oh, I finally understood suffering. I finally understood where it's coming from. I finally understood that you can shut it off. I finally understood that how you can shut it off. Those are the four Arya truths. And then inside of each of them are four different ideas happening. Okay. Now the lowest schools, for example, the Abhidharma schools, they got mixed up. Okay. They think that you perceive, for example, 15 of those 16 aspects during the direct perception of emptiness. They think there's nothing more to the path of seeing than seeing those 16 aspects or 15 aspects. Okay. They think that, and they think each one takes a moment or something like that. They believe the whole path of seeing is over in 15 or 16 seconds, and that during each one of those you see one aspect of the Four Noble Truths. So somebody from that school would say, you don't have to see emptiness directly. Okay, all you have to do is understand those Four Noble Truths, and you can get rid of your mental afflictions. Okay, they've confused the what we call Jeto Byeshi with Tongning Nunsen Vitopan. They've confused the period when you're seeing emptiness directly with what we call subsequent knowledge, which is what happens to you following the perception of a direct perception of emptiness after you come out, after you come down. Okay, they've confused those two. So they say to Master Shantideva, why do you have to see emptiness directly? If you understand these 15 or 16 aspects of the four Arya truths, everything's okay. Okay? You can get rid of your mental afflictions. And anyone, I'm not sure they would say this, but generally they're saying that anyone, whether they've seen emptiness directly or not, if they understand these impermanence and other spiritual, great spiritual ideas, then they can get rid of their mental afflictions. Okay? And they can get to be an arhat, which means reaching nirvana. They can reach nirvana. Okay? Let me get your homework out to make sure. But by the way, it is true that during the time that you are understanding the 16 aspects deeply, by the way, you never understand them directly until after you see emptiness directly. Okay? You never really understand suffering the way it really is until you've seen emptiness directly, until right after that. You really don't understand impermanence directly until after you come out of the direct perception of emptiness. Okay? But they would say, let me put it up on the board for you. It is true that you can, if you have those great ideas, you can repress your mental afflictions temporarily. Okay? And this whole book by Master Shantideva so far has been explaining to you how you can repress your mental afflictions. Okay? Which mental afflictions? There's two kinds of mental afflictions, and you have to know that to do this. Say Ngungirwa and Bhagla Nyelwa. Ngungirwa, Bhagla Nyelwa. Okay. These are the two kinds of mental afflictions. I mean, there's many ways to divide mental afflictions, like root and secondary, etc. But these are important in our discussion tonight. Ngungirwa means manifest. I translate it as manifest. Manifest means it's in your mind right now. Okay? It's up front in your mind right now. For example, when the boss is screaming at you and you're angry, that's called Ngungirwa. Okay? That's a manifested in your mind. What would you want to say? It's a directly existing in your mind, or it's appearing in your mind actively, like you're angry. So that would be Ngungirwa. That the mental affliction of anger would be present, okay, in your mind in a manifest form.
Okay.
Patla Nyawa means you're not angry right now, but you have the bakchat. Okay, bakchat means a potential in your mind. It's an energy in your mind. Bakchak can be shortened to pak. And nyelwa, those who know the kirim kirimba chukchik know nyel dan 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 dutinyang. Nyelwa means nyel. Nyel dan 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 dutinyang. What's the first kirim? Sleeping, okay? So, bakla nyelwa means it's sleeping as a potential. Okay? It's sleeping, it's dormant. How about dormant? Okay? Bakla nyawa means dormant. And lungyuro is the opposite, like active in your mind. Okay? The concept is this, you know. You can't say that you have eliminated anger from your mind just because you're not mad right now at this moment. Okay? Because you have tons of anger, bakla nyawa. Okay? Dormant in your mind. The capacity for anger you have not gotten rid of yet. Okay, you can go test it. You know, go to work, screw up some major task that your boss gave you, and check and see if you have any bakla nyawa anger. You know what I mean? And by the way, that's the concept of a monastery. You know, I mean, the first stage of treating your mental affliction disease, for if you can't control yourself, is to remove yourself from the things that might incite it. You know, it's to remove yourself from the things that might trigger it. So if you can't get rid of your anger any other way with a particular person, Buddhism says, avoid them. You know, it's the worst remedy. It's the lowest level remedy. But at least it keeps you from collecting a lot of bad karma. You know, there are times when the best antidote, if you just can't handle that mental affliction, whether it's jealousy, desire, or anger, or whatever, is just not to get in that person's way. You know, just avoid seeing that person, or don't expose yourself to that object that you desire. Okay, and that's called it's a very low level of method to get rid of to stop a mental affliction. But are you stopping the mental affliction? That's my question. You're stopping the lungyurwa. Okay, you're stopping the direct manifestation of that mental affliction. But bakla nyawa is still there. It's still dormant. And until you can get rid of the bakcha, you know, the affliction in its dormant form, you can't say you've reached nirvana. Okay? Nirvana is eliminating manifest mental afflictions and also the dormant ones. Because what's the point? I mean, you could just go lock yourself in a room somewhere and try not to think about your enemy. Okay? And you wouldn't get angry. Right? And that is basic concept of a monastery. You know, just it has to be so many fathoms from the nearest town. You just won't see anything you desire or anything that makes you very angry. You know, that's the basic concept, is to just lock yourself out of the things that might. But eventually you have to face it. Eventually you have to get rid of the potential or the seed in your mind. And you have to be able to stand there in front of the person you most hate and not get angry at all. Okay? And that's the difference. Now, Master Shantideva admits to the Hinayana guys, I admit that if you see those 16 aspects, like if your mother dies, you know, and suddenly you're thrust into this temporary realization of impermanence, it's very hard to be angry at the funeral. You know, it's very angry to think about that girl's legs at the funeral of your mother, you know. So, I mean, during a temporary state of the understanding of impermanence, you know, it's very difficult to have a strong mental affliction. But does it last? No. Okay, it'll come back. What have you removed for the period that it's lasting? You know, during your grief, you know, for the 2 or 3 days during your grief, what have you removed? The manifestation. Okay? You're not going to have extreme anger or extreme desire come up active in your mind. But you haven't done anything to the seeds, he says. So he's complaining to the Hinayana people. Look, you can have a deep understanding of the 16 aspects, okay? But that ain't gonna affect the dormant mental afflictions, the seed for the mental afflictions, the potential for the mental afflictions. You can't say that that's enough. You must what? See emptiness directly. Okay? You must see emptiness directly. And by the way, you don't really see those 16 aspects until, you know, 5 minutes after you see emptiness directly. Okay? After you come out, you start seeing them directly. So Master Shantideva says, look, your argument is dumb. Don't tell me you don't have to see emptiness because you can see those impermanence and other things. Okay? I admit that they help for a while, but you can't get rid of the seeds of them in your mind unless you see emptiness directly. By the way, if you ever read Nagarjuna, Arya Nagarjuna, as he's called, his favorite name, we translated a commentary on one of his works by Jetsun Kapa's teacher named the Sakya Rendawa. And it's an interesting book. It's called Letter to a Friend, Friendly Letter, Sorlekka in Sanskrit. And the first half of it is all these tricks about how not to get desire. It's written for monks and kings, you know, not how not to get angry. It's all these great advices like, think of the lady as your sister and you won't get desire, you know. Think of your enemy as your friend and you won't feel angry. And then about halfway through, he says, by the way, none of this stuff works. And then somebody says, well, what works, you know? And he says, seeing emptiness, of course, directly. And then they say, well, how do you do that? And then the rest of the book is really cool. It's about, you know, it's about seeing emptiness directly. It gives you the ammunition to get rid of the seeds, okay? And we'll talk about how before this night is over, all right? But you have to understand this distinction. What they claim, that if you understood impermanence, you know, during that, what we call goosebump renunciation, because it doesn't last much longer, after your mother dies, you're a very good Buddhist for like a week or a month or 6 months, you know, because you really feel suffering. And then it starts to wear off, okay? So he says, that's not enough. That will not get rid of the bokchaks of mental afflictions. It won't get rid of mental afflictions which are deep inside of you. You have to be able to stand in front of the thing that most triggers your mental afflictions and just have totally joy standing in front of them. And then you can say you've got rid of your mental afflictions. Okay? And it should last forever. It's not like just because your mother died or someone's very ill or you just heard you have AIDS or something that you're compassionate towards everybody for like a week. Okay? It doesn't happen like that. Okay? Yeah. A little bit. But again, it's just temporary. That's the problem. It's just temporary. You don't want a temporary solution to your mental afflictions. Why? They will continue to create bad karma for you, and your world will continue to be terrible, okay, as long as they do. Let me go on for a little bit, okay? So that's Master Shantideva's answer to those guys. By the way, he then gets into, look, anyway, Sutra says, the Buddha said, you have to see emptiness directly, even to get to nirvana, much less Buddhahood. Okay, to get to nirvana, you must see emptiness directly. And the Hinaya people say, where does it say that? Where did he say that? Show us. So Master Shantideva pulls out Yumkido. Okay. What's the yum in yab-yum? Yab-yum is like male, female, right? And the yum means the woman part, the mother part. Okay, it's called mother. If you see 7 years in Tibet, it's the honorific, by the way. So His Holiness is mother. Every Dalai Lama's mother is called the yum of the country. You know, she's the big yum. Okay, when you talk about your Lama's mother, you always say yum. You don't say ama or ma. Okay, you say yum. All right. Yumkido do means sutra. The mother sutras, or the mother sutra, are the sutras on the perfection of wisdom. Okay? Why? Huh? Yeah, they give birth to Buddhas. Okay? The perfection of wisdom is like a big mommy that whose child or baby, you know, it's always going around pregnant. And always producing enlightened beings, okay? That's why we call it the mommy, the mother, the yum, okay? Wisdom is called the yum, okay? Even at the beginning of the Heart Sutra, Bhagavati, you know, the female Buddha. Why? Always giving kids. What kids? Enlightened beings. Arya is another enlightened being, okay? All right, so it's called the mother. All right. The trick here is, and I ask you a question, is that a Mahayana sutra or a Hinayana sutra? It's Mahayana. It's a bigger way, okay? So is it a good argument to give to these guys? The Buddha said so in the Yom Kippur. Huh? It's not. What do they think about the Mahayana? They reject it completely, okay? They say all those Mahayana books are false. You know, they were not spoken by the Buddha. We don't agree that they were spoken by the Buddha. And whoever spoke them, they're not correct anyway. Okay, that's what they say. Okay, all those books are wrong. So here's Master Shantideva trying to convince a bunch of Hinayana people that he's right when he says what? You have to see emptiness even to reach nirvana. Okay, even to reach nirvana, which by the way is their main goal, right? Not Buddhahood. He says, you have to see emptiness directly to reach nirvana. Even the nirvana that you guys want to reach. And they say, why? He says, the Buddha said so. Where? In the Mother Sutras. That's your books, not our books. Okay? That's a Mahayana book. That's not a Hinayana book. We don't even accept it's true. Okay? Then it's a cool argument. It starts out this cool argument. So Master Shantideva says, well, are your books true? Alright? What books? The Hinayana Sutras. Okay? The Hinayana texts. What are the main three Hinayana groups? I mean, you can say Dulwa, which is what? Vinaya, okay? The monastic vows. Vowed morality, okay? Which so it treats morality. And then what's another one? Abhidhamma, okay, which mainly treats wisdom, higher knowledge. And then sutra in the sense of the Hinayana sutras, okay, Koinseka, and there's other ones, okay. So these three groups are accepted by the Hinayana people to be great books. The Buddha spoke them. So Master Shantideva says, why are your books true and ours aren't? And they start out by saying, well, you accept that they're true, and we accept that they're true. So they're true. Okay? Both of us. Two of us accept they're true. So they must be true, right? Because the people who are in Mahayana, including everybody in this room, we also accept that the Hinayana Sutras are the speech of the Buddha. They are the word of the Buddha, and they're true. So their first argument to Master Shantideva is, well, we both agree they're true, so they must be true. If two people agree they're true, they must be true, you know. Then he says, well, I guess the Rig Veda is true, the Vedas. What's the Vedas? The Vedas are the holy books of ancient India, the ancient Indians, Hindus, which are not accepted by any Buddhist school as being true. And they say, why do you say that? He says, well, you can find two people that think they're true. Okay? If it's just that you and me agree that it's true, makes it true. Which means anything that's made true by consensus doesn't mean it's true. Okay? Just saying consensus says, if a group of people say it's true is a stupid argument to say that your books are true. Okay? You can always find a group of people who will think anything is true. And it's not. For example, the Vedas. They're not, according to Buddhism, they're not true. So, just saying that you can find two folks walking down the street who say something is true, or any kind of consensus, doesn't make something true. Can you come up with something better to prove that your Hinayana books are true? And then they say something like, oh, our lamas told us they were true. Okay? And also, they fit in with the three groups of our script. You know, the ideas are okay. The Buddha said in a certain book that you can check if something is my speech or not if it teaches about the three trainings. Morality, concentration, and wisdom. If a book covers morality, concentration, and wisdom in a Buddhist way, if it talks about the subject matter of the Abhidharma, the Vinaya, and the Sutra, the three groups of scriptures that we accept, then we can say it's the word of the Buddha. And Master Shantideva just steps back and he says, let me ask you a question. You know, when you were born, when you were 5 years old, did you accept the Hinayana Sutras? And they say, no, I didn't know anything about the Hinayana Sutras. I was 5 years old. What do you want? Okay. And he says, so at some point in your life, you decided they were okay, right? You know, at some point in your life, you decided that your books were true. And they say, yeah, we did. He says, how did you do it? He said, well, we studied them, and we checked them with our own experience, and we found that they were logical. We checked them with our own experience, and we found them to be true. We checked them internally, and we couldn't find any inconsistencies in them. You know, so we think they're true. They fit the test that the Buddha spoke that a book should be true. They talk about morality, concentration, and wisdom in a Buddhist way, the three trainings. Therefore, they're true. So Master Shantideva says, well, then the Sutra of the Mother is true. And they say, why? He says, same thing. You know, it wasn't like when you were born. When we were born, we thought they were true. We came to a point in our lives where we checked them against our own experience, which is what you're doing now, right? You're here because you've checked it against your own experience. You may not be able to accept everything I've said in these classes, but I don't believe you can challenge any of it directly. You see what I mean? Like, you don't have to accept everything I say. But there hasn't been anything that rubbed you so bad that you left yet. Okay? I mean, it all seemed to be partly logical at least, okay? And hopefully I haven't said anything which is contradicts something I said on another time. You know what I mean? Hopefully what I said is internally consistent. Okay? It checks out with your experiences, and it's internally logical. So you're still here. Okay? So you're still here. So they say, look, we use the same test that you use. It wasn't like when we were kids, we automatically believed in all these books. We checked them against our own experience. We checked to see if they taught Buddhist principles of morality, concentration, and wisdom, and then we decided they were true. So we're using the same test as you're using. So you have to accept our sutras. You know, or, you know, check them, test them. You'll find the same thing. You're just believing what you believe because mommy and daddy said that. Okay? I always call it the Mrs. Melvin syndrome. Okay? Mrs. Melvin was my first grade teacher. Recently I went to my elementary school. I saw the room where she used to, you know, I remember. And she had this, she was just like the thing in the Far Side. She had this hair up like that, and she had those glasses like that. And I still remember. And she would tell us about reality. She was our teacher. So anything she said, we believed. And then there was Mrs. Butts in the fifth grade. And I don't have to tell you what we called her. Okay? And here's some two ladies, you know, who are just normal ladies. They don't know much more than anyone else. They play bridge with their friends on the weekend. You know, just normal ladies in Phoenix, Arizona. But they have, between them, determined my whole belief systems. You know, two old ladies who had no more, you know, knowledge about reality than anybody else. Just grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, and believed whatever their teachers told them and their parents told them. My whole belief system is based on this. I mean, a great part of what I believe to be true came from Mrs. Melvin and Mrs. Butts, okay? No, really, I'm not kidding. And so is it with you. It's the same thing. Most of, like, 50% of what you believe, you don't have any better reason except your parents said so, or the New York Times says so, or Mrs. Butts said so. You know what I mean? And Master Shantideva is picking on the Hinayana for acting like that, you know? Just because you ran into a teacher who was teaching Hinayana, or your parents were Hinayana, should you reject the Mahayana? Did you check it out? Did you test it against your own experiences? Did you check it to see if it was internally consistent? Did you check it to see if it works in your own life? You know, and don't believe anything else. You know, check it. Otherwise, it's like Santa Claus. You know, it's just like Santa Claus. Okay, they talked about Santa Claus. At some point, it didn't match reality. You know, and most of what we believe is similar. Most of what you grew up with is similar. What he's saying is applicable on a wider scale. Don't believe what you believe in the West because Mrs. Butts said so. You know, think about it. Check out what Buddhism is teaching, and if it makes sense, then follow it. If it doesn't make sense, then reject it. But that's his argument back to the Hinayana. Okay? Did you have a question? He said, is that similar to the distinction between seeing emptiness directly and understanding it intellectually before that? According to Buddhism, a deductive understanding counts the same as a direct perception. Okay? Do you see the pen? What's behind my back? Your perception of the pen now, according to Buddhism, is just as valid as that perception of the pen. Okay? That's why we spend so much time on logic in Buddhism. Okay? You didn't hear anything hit the floor. I was very obvious about it. According to Buddhism, if you can see the pen with the eyes of reasoning, you know, correct reasoning. It's the same as seeing it. It's as valid as seeing it directly. Okay, that's a tenet of Buddhism. Okay, does it mean that the intellectual understanding of emptiness is the same as the direct? Not at all. And does it have the same effect on you of freeing you from your mental afflictions forever? No. Okay, but it's still valid. Okay. By the way, you're still at that point. You're seeing ultimate truth in a deceptive way. Okay? You're not seeing ultimate truth, but that's a whole argument. I won't get into it. Let's see. I think we'll take a break there because I want to do an important thing after that. Okay? So take like a 10-minute break. Okay? I think I got. Try, and you shouldn't. Leave the root text the way it is. And go find Gyaltsev Jay to explain it to you. You see what I mean? So that's my approach, okay? So the root text is supposed to sound very, very short and almost crazy in places. Sometimes Gyaltsev Jay will even put a negative. He'll change it 180 degrees around to get it to explain it the right way, and he's right, he's correct, okay? So that's why the root text doesn't seem to match what you later come to find out it is. And that's a very good example. Of course you reach nirvana when you remove your mental afflictions. Master Shantideva says in the 9th chapter, you don't reach nirvana when you remove your mental afflictions. He's talking about the way of removing mental afflictions that those Hinayana schools were talking about, because they thought just by seeing impermanence, you could remove your mental afflictions forever, but everybody knows you only remove your manifest mental afflictions temporarily, so don't pick on the root text, okay? All right. Master Shantideva then sort of complains to the Hinayana schools and says, look, I agree that you can get rid of your mental afflictions for a while. If you understand impermanence, you know, if you have a death in your family, you all know that you can be very compassionate for a while after something terrible happens to you. And then it wears off, doesn't it? Okay. And this is the verse where he explains how it wears off. So I'm just giving you this as an example. Okay. These are two lines from the root text. Okay. Please say Gakpa, Laryang, Gegyur, Te. There's a thumbtack here. Dushe, Mepe, Nyomjik. Shin. That's really bad karma. No. Anyway. Gakpa means to stop something. Okay? In this case, it refers to the idea of the Hinayana people that we've been talking about, who said, you know, if you really have a great awareness of impermanence, you can stop your mental afflictions. So this is talking about that temporary stopping of the mental afflictions. Like if someone close to you dies, for like 2 or 3 days, you're kind to everybody, and then it wears off. Okay? That kind of gakpa. Any mental affliction which is gakpa or stopped that way, laryang means once more, once again. Laryang means come back again. Okay? Kegyur means they will arise again to haunt you. Okay? Okay? They will rise again. And you know that. Every time you thought you had overcome jealousy because you had a bad experience with it, then like a month later, it came up again. Okay? Because you didn't use emptiness to get rid of it. Okay? It will always come back. That's the point. Okay? You can have any kind of wonderful experience or terrible experience. You can think, I'm never going to be jealous again. You know, I shot my girlfriend. It was really bad. You can have all the resolutions you want. Until the day you see emptiness directly, it will raise its ugly head again. Okay? You know, you get divorced or something and you think, oh, I'll never go through that again. I'll never fall in love again, you know. And then, you know, 2 years later, you're doing it over again. Okay? Desire, right? And until the day you see emptiness directly, you will continue to make the same mistakes. Okay? They will come back. Laryang kegyur te. Dushe mepa Dushyamepa. Dushya is one of the five skandhas, or one of the five heaps. It's been, the poor word has been abused by all kinds of translators. It just means discrimination. Okay? Dushya means discrimination. In the Abhidharma, first chapter, it's the capacity of the mind to say, this is short, this is long, this is good, this is bad, this is red, this is blue, this is my friend, this is my enemy. It's the ability to make distinction. Okay? Dushe temar dzimbe lo. That's the root text from the Abhidhamma Kosha. Okay? It's the capacity to make distinctions. Okay? Dushe mepa means you lose that capacity. You don't have that capacity. Mepa means don't have. Mepe. Nyomjuk refers to a very deep state of meditation. Nyomjuk. I've translated just easily as a deep state of meditation. The words mean equilibrium. So some people call it meditative equilibrium. I don't like to use words more than 12 syllables or so. Okay? Deep meditation. Why is it called equilibrium? You are in a very nice halfway state between thinking about too many things and falling asleep. Okay? And you are balancing between those two. We called it like driving a car, right? You're constantly correcting. You know, and as long as you're not drunk and you're going down the New Jersey Turnpike straight, we call it nyomju, okay? Because you're steering a straight course between the two extremes of dullness and restlessness. And by the way, when you're looking at a good movie, you're there. It's just that. It's not some mystical thing, okay? It's that really good attention span. You know, that really high-tuned, intense attention towards an object. Okay? And you have it when you're watching a movie you really like, or you're reading a book that you really like. Okay? That's called nyomjuk. Shin means it's like that. It's like that. So Master Shantideva is comparing this temporary repression of your direct mental afflictions to what we call the deep meditation where you lose the capacity to discriminate. Okay? There is a kind of meditation where for a short period of time, like say an hour or half an hour, you almost lose the ability to discriminate. And that meditation is called the deep meditation where you do lose the ability to discriminate. And there's this huge debate in the monastery, you know. And I'll just tell you the end, okay? You can never turn off your discrimination, totally. It just reaches a very, very subtle level, okay? But the name of the meditation is the meditation where you lose the ability to discriminate. It's still there. And you are discriminating. Or else you wouldn't have five skandhas, by the way. You'd be down to four right then. And anyway, it's just where the discrimination is at such a subtle level that it's almost nothing, okay? When you come out of that meditation, what happens to your ability to discriminate between things? It comes back with a vengeance, okay? It's like, boom, you're back to discriminating just the same way you were before, maybe even worse. It's a very famous example in Buddhist scripture for, like, hibernating mentally. You see what I mean? You go into that meditation, and then you almost, it's almost like being on heroin or something, you know? Your mind is, like, down to almost nothing. But then when you come out of it, you're right back where you were before. Master Shantideva accuses of the Hinayana saying, he says, look, your idea of getting rid of mental afflictions as bad as this meditation, you know, big deal, you know. So somebody died in your family and for 2 weeks you're a really nice guy and then it wears off. It's the same thing as that meditation. It just comes back the same old way. What's the point? Of course you have to see emptiness. Okay? Don't give me this stuff you don't have to see emptiness because you can repress your mental afflictions for a while. Okay? Not a good argument. Okay? I think one more easy homework question. Nah, we'll do that one later. I think what question should come up in your mind now is, and it came up in my mind for 10 or 15 years, what's the connection between seeing emptiness and getting rid of my mental afflictions? Okay? Like Master Shantideva has been arguing to them, you have to see emptiness to stop your mental afflictions. I used to say, why? what's the connection between 20 minutes, you know, off in outer space somewhere, and getting rid of my jealousy, which torments me, okay? I hate my jealousy, you know? It still comes all the time. I hate it, you know? I write it in my book. It's like a constant theme, you know? I hate it. I want to stop it. What's the connection between seeing emptiness and getting rid of my jealousy? I was very frustrated through years of Buddhist study that it's even in this text, it's not clearly explained the connection between seeing emptiness directly and getting rid of my jealousy. Because I want to get rid of my jealousy. I don't care if enlightenment exists. I don't care if nirvana exists. It doesn't matter. I would really like to not have jealousy. What's the connection between seeing emptiness directly and not having jealousy? It comes in the Madhyamika textbooks of Sarame. It's quoted from a certain dude named Maitreya. Okay? If you haven't had secret teachings yet, he's a high, high, high bodhisattva. If you have had secret teachings and that initiation, he's a Buddha. Anyway, at least he's the next Buddha. At best, he's a Buddha already. Okay? Pretty good resource. Okay? I don't think I've ever gone through this in this class formally. I've done it in the Friday night classes and other places. But to me, this is one of the holiest teachings of Buddhism. You know, so try to listen. I know it's late. I know you had a lot of work to do. I mean, you've been to work and you've commuted and all that stuff. But try to catch these six steps that Maitreya puts forth in his Uttara Tantra called Gyulama, which means the higher line. It's called Tantra, it's not a Tantra. Okay, it's one of the five books of Maitreya. But in that book, in the commentary to that book especially, it's clarified the six steps of why, if you don't see emptiness directly, you can't get rid of your mental afflictions. And I love that. You know, to me, I was waiting my whole life to hear that. So here it is, okay? And I'll ask you to memorize these. It's important, okay? Your life depends on it, actually. Here's step number one. Okay, now you've got to learn this, okay? No, this one's important. Okay. I appreciate that. Okay. That's the John Stillwell thing. Say, Dangzin? Nyiki. Baksha? Yeah. Did you have time to write it? No. Okay, sorry. Go ahead. Okay, Dangzin is the tendency to see things as self-existent. Okay? It's the tendency to see things as self-existent. It's the tendency to believe that this is a pen from its own side, that its penness is not being imposed on it by your mind. Okay? If you think about it, all this is a black and white stick. It's your mind which is imposing penness on it. If that were not the case, then a dog who came in here would think, oh, look, a nice magic marker. Okay? If the penness were coming from its side, but it's being imposed by your mind due to your past karma. Your karma is forcing you to impose that on this. Okay? Dangzin is the state of mind that believes that this thing has a nature of being a pen from its own side. Okay? That tendency to see things as self-existent, ni means two. There's two kinds. In this case, by the way, it's talking about the habit of thinking that Michael Roach is self-existent and the habit of thinking that Michael Roach's parts, his fingers, his arms, and his thoughts, and everything else about him is self-existent. That's what the two tendencies to see things as self-existent. What are they? One is aimed at me. Okay. By the way, me is neither your body nor your mind. It's some kind of idea that you've imposed on your body and your mind. Okay. But you believe that to be self-existent. You believe that Michael Roach is Michael Roach from his own side, independent of me imposing that idea on these two scraggly things. Okay. I also hold each part to be that way. So those are the two kinds of holding things to be self-existent. One is focused on me, and one is focused on my parts. Now, how come they don't talk about my tendency to see that chair as self-existent? Because that tendency doesn't get me in trouble so much as thinking about myself as self-existent. This one is the first link of the 12 steps in samsara. This one, which is focused on me, is the troublemaker. This is the one that is responsible for every form of suffering that mankind endures. Okay? So this is the important one. Okay? Those two tendencies to see things as self-existent. Bhakchak means a potential in your mind to see it that way. Some kind of seed in your mind to see it that way. Yeh means you got them. Okay? You have those two seeds. From where? It's the Buddhist original sin, okay? You carried it from your past life, okay? In your mother's womb, at the moment of conception, you had them. Your mind, at the first instant of life in this realm, had these two seeds in it. So, don't blame yourself, okay? Your mind had these two seeds the moment you were conceived, okay? Too bad. That's the way it is, all right? You can't help it now. You have, when you're born in this realm, you've had it because you have them, you're born here. Ergo, if you are born here, you had them. Unless you're an emanation of some Buddha, and I don't know who's who, okay? That's the first step in the problem. Step number two. Excuse me? Yeh means you have them. Okay. Key is of, and I'll skip the keys a lot because we don't need to say so many ofs in English, okay? The seed of those two tendencies, okay? Key means of, okay? Yeah, I call it potential. I used to say mental seed, and then today I saw a scripture that said mental seeds and mental potentials are not the same, so I'm fixing it immediately. Think of it as a mental seed, okay? You are born with the seeds of the two tendencies to see things as self-existent. You have the seed of seeing things as self-existent just by being born in this realm. Say Denzin, I'm sorry, Dangzin, Ni, Ge, Dangzin, Ni, Ge. Okay, Dangzin means that habit of seeing things as self-existent, okay? That tendency to see things as self-existent. Ni means those two. What are the two? One thinks that Michael Roach is self-existent. One thinks that Michael Roach's arms and legs and thoughts are self-existent, okay? Ge means They grow. Why? Why? You were born with the seeds, okay? You were born with the seeds. So they grow, okay? And you spend your whole life seeing things as self-existent. Who? What? Me and my parts, okay? And that's responsible for all your suffering. Why? We'll get to it, okay? Those two tendencies grow. By the way, even bugs have them. Even birds have them. Dogs have them. Your stupid boss has them. Okay? Every being has this tendency that when they look at something, they think it's existing from its side and not as something created by their own mind. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Okay? Good question. Okay. Step number three. It's kind of long, but I did shorten them up as much as I could. Oh, good. He said, what's the difference between one and two? Number one is just the seed for it, looking at things that way. And then number two is when the seed grows in your mind and you start really looking at things that way. Okay. Say, rangane. Are you done? Nope. I'll wait. I thought it was self-existently written on your paper. The rest are all shorter, I promise. Okay, let's try again. Rangone Drupe Yi Ongwa Dang Yi Miong Tu Sumin Yi Che Ge. I'm not going to go in order of the words, so keep, you know, stay aware of where I am, okay? Let's work on Yije first, okay? Yije. Yije is a mental function called Yilachepa. The long name is Yilachepa. And it means to focus on something. Okay? To focus on something. It means to move the mind to an object. To focus on something. Okay? Focus on what? Let's go up to Yi Ongwa. Yi means mind. Ongwa means comes. Yi Ongwa means pretty. Okay? Comes to your mind. It means it's attractive. Okay? You can think of attractive or pleasant. Okay? Pleasant. Nice. Yi Ongwa means like something pretty or something attractive. It's called Yi Ongwa. Steals your heart away. Okay? We say steals your heart away. In Tibetan they say it comes your mind. Okay? Steals your heart away. Dung means and. Yi mi'ong is that yi'ongwa but with the negative in it. So what's it mean? Unpleasant, unattractive, ugly, bad, gross, turns off. Okay? Yi du mi'ongwa, yi mi'ongwa. By the way, we are describing here the process by which your whole existence is screwed up. Okay? I mean, the Christians say it was some mistake about a snake and an apple and all that stuff. Okay? Or whatever. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying. We say these six steps are the way that all pain in the world comes from. Okay? So it's very important. So far, what we have is you see some things as pleasant, and you see other things as unpleasant. Is that a problem? Is that in any way wrong? Use logic. Don't try to guess what I'm trying to get you to say. If I stood up here and said, look, some things look nice and some things look bad, okay? I'd rather have a protein shake here than a cup of pee-pee, okay? All right, I mean, can I say that one is nice and one is not so nice to drink? Okay. Yes, okay. Nothing wrong with that. It's not a misperception. There's nothing crazy. I don't need Madhyamika to tell the difference, okay? No problem so far. No problem so far. But we have some other words we didn't cover yet. Okay. What are they? Tsumin. Tsumin means wrong way. It's looking at them the wrong way. Okay. It's looking at the protein shake and, I don't know, what is it? Something you don't like to drink. Let's not use the other one. Like fruit juice or something. Okay. Sorry. Okay, how about motor oil, okay? Okay. All right. So, it's looking at the cup of motor oil and it's looking at the protein shake and but it's looking at them the wrong way. Okay, one looks to be nice, the other one looks to be bad to drink, but it's looking at them the wrong way. How so? That's the last words here. Rangune drupa. That's one big idiom in Buddhism. Rangune drupa. Rangune drupe. Rang means its own. Ng means side. Ne drupa means it comes from its own side. Rangune drupa, it should be like a mantra. If you're going to debate, Rangune drupa yinba thao. Da, teacher. Okay, I mean, it's like Rangunadupa, just come off your tongue like that. Rangunadupa. Okay, the pen comes from its own side. Okay, it's a magic marker on its own. The next roach that crawls around in the Quaker house here will see it as a pen because it's a pen from its own side, independent of me imposing pen on it. Okay, I don't like this pen, which exists from its own side as a pen. I like this pen, which exists from its own side as a pen. It looks good to me from its own side. It looks bad to me from its own side. It is good or bad independent of me. Okay? It is self-existently good or bad. It is self-existently a nice pen or a bad pen. And it doesn't depend on what I think about it. It's coming from its own side. That's step number three. Okay? That's crucial. Okay? What's it focusing on? The things you think are nice and the things you think are not so nice. And it's believing in the wrong way, it's focusing on them in the wrong way, and it's thinking being nice or being bad is coming from inside, not from me. Okay? That guy at work that I don't like is bad from his side, not from my side. Well, how come his wife likes him? She's crazy. Okay, you know what I mean? You really believe that it's coming from him. Well, how come the guy next to you think he's a great boss? I don't know. Sooner or later, he'll agree with me. You know, he'll come to see the truth. He's bad from his own side, not from me. Not I didn't do anything. Okay? If nothing's coming from me, he's bad from his own side. And you believe it. Okay? You really hold it. That's essential. Okay? Things look as if they were good or bad from their own side. Okay? Mistakenly. Sulman. Okay? What does that... By the way, each one of these builds on the next. Each one of these creates the next. It's a chain. It's a chain reaction. It takes about a second to happen. It takes about the time it takes for your boss to get like four nasty words out of his mouth before you've gone through all six steps. Seriously. Seriously. These six steps occur in the space of about less than 5 seconds. Okay? What's number four? Say, Dechat, Dang, Shedang, Ge. Dechat, Dang, Shedang, Ge. Duchak means liking something. It's been translated as desire. Shedong has been translated as anger. That's not the point here. How often do you get desire? I mean, what I call desire, you know, Playboy magazine desire. You know, how... If you're not Dr. Sykes, how often do you get this attack of desire? You know, like what, once a week, once a day, something like that. We're not talking about that, okay? Dechak is defined as the wish not to be separated from an attractive object. How often do you have that? About once every second, okay? I mean, in very subtle ways, you know? I like this, I like this, I like this, you know? It's not like this desire attack, okay? You can call it liking things, okay? I like to say ignorantly. You're doing it all day long. You're doing it many, many times every minute of the day. You're constantly evaluating the things around you and saying, I like this, I don't like this, I like this, I don't like this, okay? Based on an ignorant perception of them as good or bad from their own side. Okay? And that's trouble. That is the snake and the rooster that's coming out of the mouth of the pig in the middle of the Wheel of Life picture. Every temple, said the Buddha, should have this picture at the door. And Leon, being a good temple keeper, has put one at the door. Okay, so if you go upstairs, then you'll see one there. The Buddha said, I want one in the front of every temple. Why? This is the key to enlightenment. Those three animals, okay? The snake is disliking things that look to you from their own side to be nice. I'm sorry, ugly, bad, okay? And the rooster is the habit of liking things that seem to you to be from their own side nice. Okay. Where do they come from? Out of the mouth of the pig. I mean, if it's drawn properly in the ancient way, they're both coming out of the mouth of the pig. What's a pig? Ignorance. Misperceiving good and bad things. You think they come from their own side. Is it wrong to like something and to dislike something? Is it wrong for me to dislike drinking motor oil and to like drinking protein shakes. Well, then you drink the motor oil, okay? I'll bring some next week, or maybe the other thing. Maharaji Desai milkshake. Anyway, do Buddhas like things and dislike things? Let's ask that. Of course, and if you've ever seen the Dalai Lama eat something or listen to Richie Havens, you know, I saw him. Of course, Buddhas love to see people get enlightened. They hate to see people in the hells getting burned, okay? Of course they like things, and of course they dislike things. It's not like the ultimate goal of Buddhism to become a vegetable somewhere in a corner, you know. I don't like anything, I don't dislike. No, many people explain it that way. And you feel guilty, you know, that Protestant thing comes back, you know. I like something, I dislike something. Buddha said, don't like anything, don't dislike anything. And you start to feel, you know, you want to have something to feel guilty about, you know. It's like, oh, I'm guilty that I like Two Boots Pizza, you know. It's not like that. Of course, you can be a great lama and enjoy things and dislike the suffering of people. Of course. This is not talking about that, okay? Dechag means liking things ignorantly, stupidly, okay? Shedang means hating things or disliking other things ignorantly or stupidly. How often do you do it? These are tuksum. These are two of the three poisons. They're in your bloodstream all the time. You're doing it constantly. Every second of the day, you're saying, I like this, I don't like that, I like this, I don't like that, I like this, I don't like that. Is that wrong? Not by itself. Okay? The Buddha is also sitting there in every instant thinking, I don't like people to be in hell. I would love people to be in a Buddha paradise. Okay? It's not wrong. It is happening every second of the day. What makes it wrong? We'll talk about it. Okay? This is the bad one. Okay? Ke means they start. They grow. Dung means end. It's only if you misunderstand the nature of your boss. If it's only if you think that he's nasty from his own side that you can get this kind of disliking him. Okay? If you saw that it was your mind making him bad, who would you get mad at? Mr. Karma. Okay? You would get mad at your own karma. You couldn't get mad at the boss, okay? The only reason you can get mad at the boss is because you're choosing, if you're a good Buddhist, to ignore the fact that you created this guy. Am I just being metaphorical? Not at all. You have literally created the reality of this man walking on the planet for you. You created him. And I'm not being metaphorical. I'm not saying that. His very existence depends on your mind. Much less his unpleasantness, okay? If you're going to blame anybody or get mad at anybody, there's only one person. Okay? And there's only one person that can fix it. Because he was not created by Doc or Zol or Big Bang or the Creator. Those are canceled. He's created by you. Okay, we had that last class, right? What happens when you start to get mad at your boss because you think he's an asshole from his own side? Okay. I thought you could ask me to translate that other word. Actually, my lama said don't use bad words in class, so I apologize. Okay. Dechak means, it means due to number three, you develop the habit of liking some things and disliking other things ignorantly, please. Okay? Ignorantly. Does it say ignorantly? No. But it better say that, and you better say that on the homework. Otherwise, who's in this six steps of suffering who shouldn't be there? The Buddha, His Holiness, Ken Rinpoche, okay? All right? They're not there. But do they like things? Of course. Do they dislike other things? Of course. Okay? All right? But not ignorantly. Okay? Say, le sak. Le sak. Le means karma. Sak means you do it, you collect karma. Meaning, by the way, number five is, if you want to write it down simply, you yell back at your boss. Angrily. Okay? You yell back at your boss. Okay? Lesak, you commit karma. Yeah. 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 Anila asked a pretty, well, it's a great question. If the Buddha is always in a state of bliss, and if, as I said, every single millimeter of every single object in this room would be creating total ecstasy if you were an enlightened being and sitting in this room, then how can they be liking some things and disliking other things? Aren't you implying that when they look at the hells and they see beings suffering in the hells, shouldn't that give them ecstasy? Okay, and that I often like to say, brag about the fact, you know, I was assigned to be the first questioner during the Geshe examinations of the third Pabongka Rinpoche. Okay, like I was the first debater because I was at the time the senior non-Geshe of our college, so I asked him the same question. You know, I said, if the Buddhas are perceiving people in the house suffering, and if they don't like that, then something in the universe is not creating ecstasy in them, right? You know, and there was a huge debate. You know, it went on for like 2 hours. The bottom line is, they can be aware that you are perceiving it that way. Okay, they can be aware that you're not having a good time about the same objects that are creating bliss in them. They cannot directly experience a hell realm. They're in paradise all the time. But they're aware that you don't see it that way. Okay? They're aware that you don't see it that way. Do they feel some kind of bad feeling in the sense of being upset or suffering? No. They feel some kind of tender love for you. Even that love is ecstasy for them. You know, compassion or mercy or it's a kind of ecstasy for them. The object is suffering and they don't like that. But they also understand that it's only you perceiving it that way. Okay? They're not perceiving it that way. All right? It's subtle, very subtle. Okay? Okay. So lesak means you do something bad, you yell back. Okay? Yeah, Andy. Even long before that. But by the way, as you're a Buddha, you'll be sitting there saying, gee, the Quaker house looks like a Buddha paradise to me tonight. I wonder why. Oh, it's just an illusion. I collected the karma and now I'm forced to see it this way. And so even while they're experiencing it, they're totally aware that they created it. But it does not make it less functional. It does not make it less real. If you don't think so, go out in front, stand in front of that illusory Pakistani taxi. And, you know, see if it breaks your illusory legs when it hits you. Of course, it's not real in the sense of having its own nature. But the experience is totally real. They can read your mind perfectly. Your mind is a sheja. Your mind is a knowable object. And they know it, because they know all knowable objects. They know how you're perceiving reality, although they're not perceiving it anymore that way. Okay. It's very subtle, you know. They can be perceiving themselves as a tantric god, and you can be perceiving them as a plain old schmuck. And that's not contradictory. And they can be aware that you're perceiving them as a plain old schmuck, but that doesn't mean that they don't see themselves as a tantric god. Okay. No contradiction. Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about it right now. Okay? Last thing. Step number 6. Say, korwar, kor. Korwar, kor. He's making a pun. Hear it? Korwar, kor. Okay? Korwa is the Tibetan word for samsara, meaning the cycle of suffering. Kor means the verb to wander around in a big circle. Okay? Korwar kor means you're circling around in the big circle of suffering. Okay? If you want to put it in plain English, you have just perpetuated your suffering. You have just perpetuated your suffering. Why? Because you lesak. What's lesak? You yelled back at the boss. Okay? Why? Because you disliked him ignorantly. Why? He looked to be bad from his own side. Why? Because you have that kind of ignorance. Why? It's not your fault. You were born with those seeds in your mind, okay? That's the whole thing backwards, okay? We call it Lung Jung and Lung Dok. You can go either way. You know, it's fun to go through it, bup, 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 and then da 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 do. You know what I mean? It's a mental meditation. It's in your meditation, okay? In the monastery, we do the 12 links. We go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 12, then we go 12, 12, 12. You know, we debate it that way, back, forth, back, forth, back, forth, like that. And you should do it that way, too. You know, why does your boss exist? Because you yelled at a boss in the past. Well, why did you yell at a boss in the past? Because you didn't like him, ignorantly. Well, why didn't you like him ignorantly? Why did you dislike him ignorantly? Well, because he looked to me to be bad from his own side. Well, why did he do that? Because I had ignorance. Why? Because I was born with the seed for it, and then it grew in my mind. I can't help it. Okay? All right, you got to go back and forth like that. Okay? And then that perpetuates the thing. What is the only possible way to have an ugly, stupid, screaming boss reappear in your life in the future, according to Buddhism? Yell at him. That's korwa kor. That's perpetuating the cycle. And that's why Master Shantideva in the last class said, kiss those ugly things in your life goodbye. Why did he say that? Because if you stop doing this, they're going to get less and less in your life. And you can check it out. Check it out. You know, watch your behavior during the day. I suggest you keep this little book, okay? Which we'll talk about on Monday nights if you want to come, okay? How to do the book. It'll come up in the next few weeks. But monitor your own behavior, you know? Catch yourself committing stupid karma, okay? And then work backwards. And then eventually, the lousy things in your life will start to disappear. Statistically, they will get less. It's very interesting. You know, instead of meeting a bad person every 5 minutes, it'll be every 10 minutes. Seriously. And then it'll get to be once a day. And then it'll get to be once a week. And then you swear to God that New York is full of these sweet, charming people. You know, and people who come here from out of town who didn't do this practice swear to God that New York is full of these crazy, insane people. You know, but your personal experience of New York City will start to become a Buddha paradise. Honestly. Seriously. No problem. You'll never meet those bad people. They'll get less. That's the whole idea. Was Rome built in a day? No. You have to start. As you start not responding to your boss, they start to get less and less. It's a gradual process. Towards the end, you start having glimpses of a Buddha paradise. You know, like once a week, and then twice a week, and then three times a week, and then it's half the day, and then it's three quarters of the day. And then it gets to be really amazing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The difference between 3 and 4 is that number 3 is just the perception that this pen is nice from its own side. And then number 4 is coming after that, and it's, I like this pen. Okay. Hang on 1 sec. Yeah. Nuns first, okay. Anila said, you know, really if you think about it, if you've got a good intellectual understanding of your boss's emptiness, then you could slowly start to change your behavior and he would start to disappear. So why is it you have to have this totally powerful direct perception of emptiness? I can't give you a really good answer to that except to say that the understanding of his emptiness after that is totally different than the intellectual understanding. I mean, it's a totally different level. It's totally, totally, it's much, much deeper. It's infinitely deeper. And also you just, I guess it's the effect of seeing all these things like your future lives, seeing the day of your enlightenment, things like that. What, according to the definition of nirvana, is that you stop your mental afflictions permanently because you saw the 16 aspects, because you saw emptiness directly. So it's apparently your experience of those 16 aspects is totally different after you've seen emptiness directly than before that. And that has much more power. Does it work? It won't destroy your mental afflictions permanently. They can reassert themselves. Okay. No, I gave a long refutation of that idea, right? The Buddha likes things, the Buddha doesn't like things. Does the Buddha respond to bad things by taking some action? Yes. Does the Buddha respond to, did the Buddha kill somebody in his past life in order to save other people's lives? Yes. Or actually, in order to protect that person from something very terrible. You can take very forceful action. It may be appropriate, even if you're an enlightened being, if you're sitting in my particular office and the boss comes in and screams, it may be totally the correct action to scream back at him, but never with ignorance and never with anger. You see? It may be the correct thing to forcefully stop that person, and that's a bodhisattva code, in fact. You have to protect other people's lives and property, for example. It may be very appropriate to act forcefully towards someone, but never with a negative emotion, because that's just straight old bad karma. Okay? Yeah. I didn't quite catch it. You said, I couldn't hear anything. You said rent-free apartment and then?
People.
Oh, that you've known in the past or something? Okay. Yeah, right. Okay. The question is, you have a cycle of anger, right? Like you feel angry about somebody and then it makes you more angry and then you have more anger, and how do you stop it? Buddhism says understanding. Buddhism says to understand these six steps is extremely powerful. There's a great emphasis on Buddhism that just understanding what's going on, which is called the perfection of wisdom, just understanding what's going on is enough to stop it. Okay? The whole idea of Buddhism, the whole idea of the Buddha coming to teach on this planet, was that if he could explain to a normal, intelligent American what they're doing wrong, they can stop it. And that's what we truly believe. We don't believe that they can bless you with their hands. We don't believe you can pour water on their head. The first Dalai Lama, in his commentary to the Abhidharma Kosha, goes through a list of stuff that doesn't work. And he includes washing people on their head, transferring your knowledge to another person with ESP, blessing somebody by putting your hands on their heads. He said, doesn't work that way. The only way to get out of suffering is to understand these six points, is to understand where it's coming from. And the human mind, a normal, plain old, intelligent, halfway intelligent American person, if they hear these six steps enough, can get themselves out of suffering. And that's what the Buddha said. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, Nina said, of course, there's people who may understand this theory very well, but can't put it into their actual life's practice. Of course, that's true. It starts with understanding. If you don't do anything about it, of course, nothing will happen. That's true. But the understanding has to come first. Yeah. But of course, if you don't act on it, nothing will happen. Okay. But it's very difficult to keep understanding it long enough and not do something about it. Okay. It's very difficult. Although it's possible, right? Surgeon General has determined that this stuff kills you. And, you know, people go on smoking it, you know. That's true. That's true. Yeah. Oh, great. What about anger that you're experiencing in a dream? What happens? There's a couple of viewpoints on that. For example, monks have a vow of celibacy. So there's a question in the Vinaya. If you dream about breaking your vow of celibacy, are there any implications? Are there any repercussions on your vows? And it says no. Okay, it's not a reality. It's not real. So it does not have any repercussions. Your vows are not damaged in any way. Okay, so as far as like murdering somebody in a dream, you don't have to go and... It may be useful to confess that you had a dream like that, but you don't have to confess murdering anybody. Okay, you can confess thinking about it in a dream or something like that. Any time, the fourth chapter of the Abhidharma Kosha says, "Lele jikta nazoke deni semba danteche." The essence of karma is any thought. Anytime you have a thought, the essence of karma, raw concentrate like Coca-Cola concentrate, concentrate karma is thinking. You know, deche luda ngakile means, and then words and actions come later. But it's the driver is up here. You know, just having a thought has repercussions on your mind stream, and that's true even of dreams. You know, just having a dream about doing something really bad has a very, very weak but a very certain effect on your consciousness. So yeah, it is a kind of, you do collect some kind of karma because you have a thought. It's very, very feeble. It's very, very weak. It won't have much repercussions. Most of the requirements for what we call leki lam, a total karma, are not there. But of course, just having the thought affects you slightly. And the opposite is very famous. You know, your Buddhist practice gets to a point where you'll be starting to lie in your dream and you'll stop. You know, and if you've gotten to that point, it's very cool. You know, you'll be starting to do something bad in your dream and you say, wait a minute, I'll have to write that in my book. You know, and you'll find yourself, even in your dreams, you won't do bad deeds. If your practice gets sweet, you'll find that you'll even be dreaming Buddhist practice. You know, yeah. Is it possible to change what? Yeah, John said, is it possible to change the karma that comes up and you know, affect it? Patricia Duffett knows. Tricycle Magazine is coming out with a next issue, a whole section on purification of karma. And there's a little part in there from the called the Sutra of the Four Forces, how to purify that karma. You know, if it's coming up, how to stop it, and if it did come up, how to clean it off your mind. And you can read it when it comes out. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, what it means is, if you see emptiness directly, you have bashed number two. If you see emptiness directly enough, you destroy number one. Okay? Seeing emptiness directly and the habit of seeing things as self-existent cannot coexist in the same mind. Okay, so for 20 minutes you're not having it, okay? What happens when you come out? The habit is still there. How do you destroy that habit? You continue to meditate on emptiness. Directly, not necessarily, okay? But remembering what happened to you and constantly applying it to your life, eventually you get rid of your mental afflictions, okay? So it's really going for the jugular of samsara, you know, which is what? It's that tendency to see things as self-existent. That's the whole point. By stopping the earlier causes, the rest collapses like a house of cards. Okay. One more question, then we got a two more minutes thing. Yeah. 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 By the way, I remember in India going to a sermon in a church. When I first got there, I was a Christian, you know. And I went to a sermon in a church, and there was this Indian minister there, and he was covering a text from the Bible called, "Why Do the Wicked Prosper?" You know, why does it seem like when you're doing good things, you're getting lousy results, and when you're doing lousy things, you seem to be doing quite well? And why is it that these creeps in business seem to make a lot of money, and the nice guys seem to not make a lot of money, and stuff like that? Buddhism explains it perfectly. I mean, you can be a saint in the present moment and be experiencing all the lousy karma you did before that. And in fact, in this reading, you'll see some of that. It's no contradiction in Buddhism that in 1997, you're suffering a lot from the bad deeds you did from 1955 to 1997. And from 1997 on, things are going to get better because you stopped doing them. You know, but the old bad deeds are still there, and they will continue to haunt you for a while. But you can purify them if you know purification, and you can also you're going to stop doing them. So Master Shantideva didn't say the day after you start practicing patience, you won't meet any assholes, okay? He just said, if you start practicing patience in a serious way, they'll get less and less until one day they disappear. Okay. Okay, last thing. There's kind of a cool section at the end here. And somebody comes up to Master Shantideva and says, "I like what you said about emptiness. I get it. I'm not like those Hinayana guys. You convinced me. But I went to my room and I tried to meditate on emptiness and I got scared. You know, it was kind of scary, you know. I'm not sure I can do it. It'd be really weird to go around thinking about everything, you know. Like my whole day at work would be ruined. It would be changed completely if I couldn't yell at my boss, if, you know, if I had to see my boss as my projection. This guy is coming from me. You know, it gets kind of weird. Life becomes weird. It's a little scary. Okay, I don't know if I can do it." And Master Shantideva answers him. Okay, last thing. Say Dimba. Dzimba. Dumya. Geje. Tongyi. Tokpa. Dumya. Shije. Okay, this is a paraphrase of the verse. You'll see the verse is a little bit different. Okay. Dimba Dzimba means that tendency to see things as self-existent. Okay. Dimba Dzimba is the tendency to see things as self-existent, to think that that your boss's ugliness is coming from him and not from you. Okay. Dunya means all the pain you ever had. Dunya. Keje means it causes all the pain you ever had. Okay? That single act of thinking that the bad things in your life are self-existent and not that they are created by you is the source of all your suffering. Why? Because then you react to them negatively and you collect more bad karma. Okay? When you get serious about Buddhism and about understanding emptiness, you can't even be grumpy anymore. Okay. By the way, if Buddhism was all wrong, and if emptiness was a big lie, and if there was no enlightenment and no nirvana, it would still be more fun not to be grumpy all day. Okay? All right? I mean, Buddhism is still valid, in my mind. Even if all that stuff about being enlightened and entering a Buddha paradise is all a big lie, it's telling you, you can't even be grumpy without collecting some bad karma. Sorry, you can't even have a low day, you know. You have to be bright, cheerful, joyful, maintain your joy, even under the heaviest crap you can imagine, you know. You cannot react to even low-level, crap in your life with anything less than joy, because then you're just perpetuating it. It's very interesting, okay. You can't even have like a grumpy day, really. Okay? It's very interesting. Say, Tongyi, Tokpa, Dunya, Shije. Tongyi Tokpa means realizing emptiness. In this case, seeing emptiness directly. Okay? Seeing emptiness directly. Dunya means all that suffering in your life. everything lousy in your life, 두냥. 시제. 시제 means it stops it. It stops it. Okay? It stops it. So Master Shantideva comes up to you and says, don't you get it? All the suffering in your life, everything that you could be, that could be pain for you, which means all the things that scare you about your life, they're all coming from your inability to see emptiness. So don't get scared about seeing emptiness. This is going to stop all the things you're afraid of. It's very cool. If you read the verse, it's very cool. He says, look, I admit you might get a little uncomfortable meditating about emptiness once in a while. But what's really scary in your life is your life. You know? And your life exists because you don't understand emptiness. So if you really want to stop things that are scary, meaning your age, your aging process, you know, the up and down of your life, the fact that you're going to be dead in a couple of years, that's scary. Now that's scary. And the fact that every day you're getting weaker and uglier, that's scary. The only way you can fix it is to see emptiness directly. So don't come to me and tell me you're nervous about meditating on emptiness, okay? It's the only way you can get out of it. Okay? All right? It's very cool. You can read it. He gives a very cool answer. What's scary is living like we have been living. You know, that's the scary part. If you have to put up with a little weirdness when you're meditating about emptiness, don't worry about it. Okay? You're getting rid of the rest by doing that. Okay? All right.
This is the end of Class 4. You have been listening to A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, Part 3, with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.